we're going to come to order. I apologize for the delay. I don't know if you got the message about it being postponed 20 minutes due to the caucuses that were going on. I don't know how caucuses can kind of even get more windy than if you give them some time, but I guess that's what we do here. So I appreciate you coming. I may review this for people as they come late as well. There's been a change in what we were proposing to do tonight. The guests at the table were arranged, and we appreciate them being here. And the other two groups you're hoping to hear from, by the way, we realize that three presentations is about all we can handle in an evening. We tried four in the beginning, and that was a little bit too much, so we tried to slow down the pace. And so we were going to hear from the pharmacy benefit managers and from the pharmacists, and one of the gentlemen, I believe, had a death in the family, the other one got sick. So they're not going to be here. So the delay won't cause us a tremendous loss in the content. We do have the gentleman from North Western Health Sciences University talking about spinal manipulation and some responses to some DHS recommendations. And then Mr. Sullivan, if there's time at the end, we'll get to hear from him. We hope we won't bounce you again. So welcome. I see him in the audience. So anyway, that's the plan for today. I will introduce Dr. Trainer in a minute. What we're going to do is they've got about a 20-minute presentation. I'll go through your packets here. Maybe I'll go through the packet at a break when more people have gotten here from of the members. In your packet, relative to this, on the top of the packet, by coincidence, is a Cochrane collaboration thick deal. Remember, it's an honors course. There's an article by William Austin Delft. Maybe you can pronounce the name better for me later on. But that's the study that the DHS referred to. There's a couple more studies on primary care and the spine journal. These are related to this presentation here on this topic. And deeper in your packet, or just one behind there, you'll see this handout here. And this is a product of the Department of Human Services, and it's the appendix to their state operated services proposal that they brought to the committee, the full committee, I don't know, a month ago or something like that. And this is the appendix. And they had a panel that worked on, did some work, and they had some strategies they were working through in cost containment. And interesting enough, in Appendix C, page 66 to the end of the handout, they had some overused services that they at least were proposing that might be overused. And then they have some studies that support that. Part of what I'm trying to accomplish today is as to make it clear to you, as it is to me, that it's hard to know what a good service is. And it's easy to look back in time and say, well, that was a waste of time. But until you sometimes do it and find out it didn't work, you don't know that it wasn't going to work. And maybe that was the cost-effective way to attempt. I hope you take away from the presentation today that I picked out one topic out of here because I understand that one the best. Some of the studies that are the ones that are being used to demonstrate the value or lack of it of a particular technology are actually relatively mediocre studies. And as we search for our truth in our work here, we want to have better and better work. And so if we as legislators can better dissect what a good study is and what a bad study is, that's part of today's assignment with the experts here. Specifically on page 68, we're going to be, the reason we broach into this topic here is on item number 4, where it talks about the superiority or not of spinal manipulative therapy relative to standard treatments for various kinds of back pain. And so you have, if you are good students, you'll listen well to the testimony now and then go home and study in depth these four handouts. There will not be a test, however. But that's the point of today. And part of, it's no secret that part of where people see some of the savings coming is in using best practices. And I couldn't agree more. But we want to use them wisely. And so with that, I'll greet Dr. Trainer, who introduced his guest. And then they're going to present some testimony. And for 20 minutes more or less, and after that we'll have some time to ask questions, and I hope you have a good number of questions for our witnesses. So welcome, Dr. Trainer.
Thank you, Chairman Abler, and committee members, I want to thank you for the privilege and opportunity to address the committee today. I represent Northwestern Health Sciences University as the president, and we are located in Bloomington, Minnesota. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Geert Bronfert, who is our director of our neck and low back research. And he's right next to me, and the bulk of the presentation will be given by him, because he is the expert. Just a little bit of background information. Northwestern Health Sciences University is a tuition-dependent, nonprofit, natural healthcare university represented by the following programs, and that's acupuncture, oriental medicine, massage therapy, chiropractic, and we have an integrated health and wellness certificate program. We have institutional accreditation through North Central and individual programmatic accreditation for our acupuncture, oriental medicine, and chiropractic programs. Our purpose here today is to call attention to Appendix C, page 68, in reference to spinal manipulation for low back pain. And this is in the healthcare services study. In 1999, the Cochrane Collaboration systematic review of the literature was referenced regarding spinal manipulative therapy, as authored by Asendelf et al. It is our intent today to clarify the findings and conclusions of this study and also to share current information and more evidence related to spinal manipulative therapy for low back pain. Dr. Geert Bronfert is here as a resource to clarify and provide interpretation of the best new available evidence. Dr. Bronfert has been at Northwestern Health Sciences University, formerly Northwestern College of Chiropractic, since the early 80s, and has created the infrastructure for the research program there. As you see on the next slide here, with regard to spinal manipulation for low back, the scientific evidence has been developed through Dr. Bronfert, and we've got a list of his credentials here. He's the director of the Neck and Back Research Program at Northwestern. He has his PhD in clinical research. He's been the principal investigator on several federally funded studies to the tune of over $6 million, and that's happened since 1999, even though he's been there creating the infrastructure for the research department before that time. He's scientific reviewer for National Institutes of Health, the NIH. He's a member of the Cochrane Collaboration, the very collaboration that we use as a resource to validate spinal manipulation for low back pain. He's on the steering committee and is a member of NIH-funded Research Training Center in Minneapolis. And he's research advisor to WHO, NIH-funded Research Center in Oregon, and value of chiropractic services in the VA system and the U.S. National Chiropractic Evidence-Based Best Practices Initiative. There's also a list of some of the publications, and I won't read through all of those, but these are selected publications from research department at Northwestern Health Sciences University. Our research is usually the best of the research, and that means we do randomized controlled trials, and these are some of the publications as a result of those randomized controlled trials. And just to highlight very briefly, we've got chronic tension type headache, chronic low back pain, migraine headache, spinal manipulation is current state of research and its indications. We have chronic neck pain, low back pain and neck pain, and chronic recurrent headache. So these are just a summary of some selected publications as a result of our randomized controlled trials. Basically what I'm doing is introducing Dr. Bronfert, who is an expert in research, an expert in working with randomized controlled trials, and can serve as a wonderful resource in being able to determine and clarify what the research is really telling us when we look at these randomized controlled trials. So without further ado, I'll have Dr. Bronfert take over.
Thank you very much, Dr. Traina. It is a privilege for me to be here and testify in front of this committee. And what I'm going to try to do is help interpret some of the recommendations from the healthcare services studies, study that was published recently and released here in January. I want to commend the Department of Health and the state of Minnesota for taking this initiative of moving from what you've recognized as being decision made basically primarily on cutting costs to a more evidence-based approach and letting the scientific evidence guide the decision-making process. And I think that's a great step forward, and I hope a lot of states will follow that same track. What I'm going to talk about here first are some examples of inappropriate use of healthcare services that have been identified by this survey and presented to you as maybe the premier or the first tier of areas where healthcare cost savings could be made. And some of these are coronary angiography, as you see here on this list, antibiotic use and arthroscopic knee surgery for arthritis. So it's a number of different both diagnostic procedures and therapeutic procedures, some of which I think the indication here may be that they are not effective and therefore not should not be supported and recommended and reimbursed. And spinal manipulation for low back pain falls in that category. It's not really clear whether the healthcare services study shows that this is an inappropriate use of that or whether they are trying to say with this reference that it is actually an ineffective therapy. Obviously, there's a lot of effective therapies that are being used, overused, and or used inappropriately. And that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be supported, but you need to find a system by which you can make sure that they are used appropriately. And we'll get back to that at the end of my presentation. So when you look at the scientific evidence, it's actually a science in itself to summarize and synthesize the literature that's out there, and it's best done in systematic reviews. And it just so happens that the study that is referred to in this report is such a systematic review and probably one of the latest. So it's a very good study to be pointing to guide the decision-making process. But it's very important, though, that all relevant scientific studies are looked at and that the quality of the evidence is evaluated and that it is done systematically and it's combined and summarized in a way that makes sense to both caregivers, patients, and policymakers. And then that the conclusions are made and recommendations are made on the preponderance of the evidence and not on selective choosing of some of the evidence that is out there. So that's the principle I want to stress very much, that you have to look at the preponderance of the evidence and you have to consider the quality of that evidence. Dr. Trina talked a bit about the Cochrane Collaboration. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. It's an international nonprofit organization that prepares, maintains, and disseminates systematic and up-to-date reviews of healthcare interventions. It is probably at this point one of the most influential international groups in terms of setting policy within healthcare, and this goes both for North America and Europe and other places. Now let's turn to spinal manipulation for low back pain, which is the topic that we are looking at today, and I'm going to present to you the summary of the two most recent systematic reviews. It just happens that our group have done a systematic review and actually were offered for that to be a Cochrane review in case that this review we're going to talk about first was not finished in time. It has been underway for many years and they had a certain deadline by sometime last year, and if they couldn't make it, they had looked at our systematic review and offered to replace this review with it. So you have to look at it in that context. But this is the very study we are talking about. It covers 39 randomized trials that were done up till the end of 1999, and it used a special technology that is not normally used for systematic reviews, but it's a bit of an experiment in terms of the methodology of synthesizing the literature. It's normally used for subgroup analysis and not primary analysis. And what they found was that for patients with acute low back pain, spinal manipulation was superior to sham therapy or therapies judged to be ineffective or even harmful. What that means is that it is an effective treatment, but also that it had no statistically or clinically significant advantage over general practitioner care, analgesic, and other treatments shown to be effective for the management of low back pain. And for chronic pain, the result was similar. And here, it didn't really matter who was providing the, according to this review, who was providing the manipulation, whether it was doctors of osteopathy, what a Cochrane review looks like.
And maybe just, we have another question, but maybe what you could do, I like giving my good members your homework to read. I don't want to give you all those systematic reviews to read, but maybe you can get us a list of the ones, of what conditions there's a systematic review for, so if members wanted to research a particular topic, that might be worthwhile. And I suppose there's a whole list of, if you can get us a list of one of these good analyses for, I think that would be productive. You can get it to Jason, and then we'll you get one or two samples perhaps, or members could pick and choose or pull them off the web. Representative, help me.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Bronford, this is different than chiropractic, so I'm not, but are there systematic reviews or Cochrane reports on homeopathic medicine?
Dr. Brown. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, there is. I believe there's a big review on homeopathy. I believe that's been also translated into a Cochrane review and updated in the Cochrane collaboration, but I can find that out specifically for you. I know that there's a large review that was published in the British Medical Journal a few years back, but I believe that it's now in a Cochrane review or in the making.
That's not helping.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Bronford, if you could just email me the the citations, I can have the people on the sixth floor get them for me.
Dr. Bronford, how long is that? Is that a long one?
Mr. Chairman, I believe I'm just going on recall now. It's a long time since I looked at that, but all the Cochrane reviews are pretty lengthy. You know, they're technical reports, but they are made in such a way that anybody, even the end user, the patient, have a section that is translated in such a way that they can get meaningful information out of the review. So that there's both the technical part, the scientific part, and a part for patients and consumers.
And Doc, how many Cochrane reviews are there then? Is it 100 or is it 20?
Mr. Chairman, I believe this is rapidly expanding. I believe that there's at least 1,500 reviews at this point in time.
Really?
Yeah.
Remarkable. You don't want all those copies of Synthesis to be. Well, I appreciate that. That's from Bradley. How much homework do you want?
I pass.
I think we've just about. I appreciate you coming, Representative Bradley. I think you know what we're doing here. Did you? We were.
On top of my account. I'm sorry.
Oh no, it's all right. We just. We were referencing the Appendix C of the Department of Human Services report about spinal manipulation, which is what provoked me to invite Dr. Train and Dr. Bronford to come, and the conclusion that they came to, and we talked about that. It's in the handouts, and it's. And Cecily has been talking about that the conclusion doesn't necessarily match the study that was put there. And so we're talking in terms of general things that are considered to be used appropriately or not. So if we invite you back, you wouldn't mind coming, huh? Okay, well, we'll appreciate you coming today. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Sullivan, they can clean up, and Mr. Sullivan can come. Let me go through the handouts that you've gotten. Listen, Betty, just for your information, the top four are related to this presentation. The this one here, the Assendelft, get my glasses on. This one here is the study references by DHS, and we talked about that one. And there's some other studies on the topic that you can look at. So that's interesting. And then we have the appendix that you've all seen before. And then the review of what you got in your packets here. I'm from the Equal Opportunity Xerox, so this was brought to me by the Cancer Society folks. They would, since smoking costs money, then if we don't smoke, it's cheaper and saves money in the system. It does fit into our topic, so here's your chance to read about that if you didn't have enough to read. There's two more items. I'll put my glasses on so you can. There's an article and an email presentation from Dr. Geist, who has some ideas that I think you'll find provocative and I think interesting, trying to provoke your thinking. And Senator Berglund and Attorney General Hatch had a deal about. And I wanted to talk about this for a second. I'm not sure this is the way to go about it, their idea about charging people without insurance less money, because you run into all kinds of issues related to fraud. I can't have two fee systems. But I think it calls attention to a problem where if you have Blue Cross and you walk into the hospital, usually they cut the price in half. You show them your card, your deductible is not even met, but you pay half what the rack is. You walk them through it with an uninsured person, you get to pay the price that's posted, if they can tell you what that is. Anyway, so that's an interesting problem, and one solution, which I don't know that we're going to go that way, but it's a solution, a problem. Just the little health exec dollar payment thing you might find. These are all from the paper. Talking about compliance with doctor's orders, these are some of the articles that just in recent local papers. Part of the challenge is to provide people with the right to get to see a doctor. The other challenge is to get them to do what you said. And either way, the outcome might be bad. But if they don't go, they get charged against the outcome, and the cost that they did get was maybe wasted. Prescription drug prices, drug sales are going down. That means it's kind of drug day. That's why we have these here. Does that mean prices might go up if their sales are down? Just kind of a joke. And some more drug things in the state health insurance for the teachers, I put that in here, and I'm not sure if they're going to hear that here, but it's another thing that's asserted to be a way to save some money. And then they asked about homeopathy, and I got this email from this homeopathy student, and she gave me an interesting history, which I thought was kind of just worth members being exposed to as an interesting thought. And it turns out this was kind of popular before any of us were around in the 1800s. And with some success, and I think it's just interesting to see what things we've not done that used to be of some value. And I don't know how homeopathy and these cholera results that they claim to have, which I believe they did have, just based upon history of being reported as accurately as they could have back then, how that would connect with our current antibiotics and what we might do now compared to that. But it's an interesting place to look at. This other one is nutrigenomics. This fellow here is from Washington. He's a PhD. He spent his career looking at nutritional ways to deal with some of the challenges that we now medicate for, and has some profound results. It's just a little one blurb thing. Here's a website if you want me to find that for you. This one here is about if the doctors knew what drugs cost, maybe they wouldn't use them so much. They would use cheaper ones because they don't know what things cost all the time. Your garden variety HSA testing out in New York article. And then this next one it's the middle article actually, talking about, something like a Huntley term, technocrats. You know? Take over sentence, patient-oriented medicine. So, and I didn't realize this when I ripped this out, but there's a person you recognize being quoted here, Atwata Braze has got the quote there, so I didn't know I was giving her some credit, but so she appears on our tabletop too, in the interest of equal opportunity for all. Any comments about those members? Kristen Huntley, you're here today.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, just to talk about the Berglund Hatch thing on people that don't have insurance pay the highest price, and that's it's similar to what's happened to the airline industry tickets since we deregulated airlines. Everybody in airplanes paid a different price for his ticket.
Yeah.
If you believe in the marketplace, then you would say, so what? If you believe in fairness and equity, and any economist would tell you that the marketplace has nothing to do with fairness and equity.
Fair enough. And just to that point, I'm led to believe that in my practice, if Mr. Sullivan comes to my office and hasn't got insurance, and you do, and if I charge him a different price than I charged you, that's called fraud. And so I was told that the Attorney General could come, or the insurance commissioner or some federal anti-racketeering person could come and tell me I've done a wrong thing. And so we're terrified as we practice just trying to do our normal business. And so I appreciate that it is a problem. What's this? Okay. And Mr. Sullivan, I appreciate coming back. I think that you've gotten in the past some information about doctor report cards, the cardiology stuff. We didn't get a chance to have him finish up his testimony, and I asked him to come back and give us 5 or 8 minutes on the topic of report cards and some of the challenges that some of those present and some of the ill effects. And we told you that you'd come back, and it worked out thanks to the other people that couldn't be here who give you a chance to make your point. And I you have a handout that you're going to go through that? So Mr. Sullivan, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and say your thing.
Thank you very much for having me back. After watching two proponents of report cards take up an hour and 15 minutes of the committee's time on February 2nd and February 8th, I feel that Lady Justice was just crying out to give me a little more than 15 minutes to respond. The coalition that I work with, the Minnesota Universal Healthcare Coalition, I'm going to be very critical of the idea of report cards. So I want to make it very clear what it is we're against and what we're for. We have no problem with guidelines, competent guidelines developed by competent people. We think they can help busy doctors, and we have absolutely no problem with all variety of quality improvement. Our objection is to the growing interest, both in this legislature, in the business community, in the governor's office, in reporting grades on providers and requiring state agencies to use those grades to punish low-scoring plans and low-scoring providers. We think that the evidence to support such a policy is ambiguous at best. And in fact, there's a small but growing body of evidence that report cards, even rigorously adjusted report cards, take into account some of the things Dr. Train was talking about, differences in patient income, health literacy, etc. Even rigorously adjusted report cards, costing Lord knows how much, cause doctors to begin to reject sicker patients. And I urge this committee and the legislature to take a look at that data before you support legislation, which I understand has been introduced in both houses, that would require DHS and Dewar to punish low-scoring plans and to make contracting decisions based on those plans. There's nothing really we can do to stop the Smart Buy Alliance from using its leverage to do that, except, I hope, public embarrassment. So essentially, I've got two messages here. The first is, essentially, it's the same that you just heard from the last two witnesses, which is quality of care is extraordinarily difficult to measure accurately. And I want to talk first about a problem that isn't just measuring what a doctor does in an office. It's the problem in deciding whether a given so-called quality measure has anything to do with what the provider is offering, and perhaps everything to do with some other part of the system. Lack of insurance, high drug prices, even a relatively small copay for a drug insurance, health literacy, nurse shortage. There are a host of factors that can affect the scores that you saw last week produced by the Community Measurement Project. There are a host of factors that could affect the RAND study, which BCAG and Health Partners cited in their testimony. The RAND study was cited by BCAG to support the following statement, and I think I'm quoting, I'm quoting from their PowerPoint. They said, you have a 50% chance of getting the right care when you visit the doctor. And she cited the RAND study published in 2003. The RAND study, which you handed out, I think, last week, does not support that statement. What the RAND study supports is the following statement. The average American is going to overuse the system about 11% of the time, get care that isn't useful, and underuse it 46% of the time. Now, that's a vastly different statement from the one you got from BCAG. The latter statement doesn't tell you why half of Americans are underusing the healthcare system, and 11% are overusing it. And because it doesn't tell you why, you cannot then jump to the conclusion that the reason Americans are so poorly served by the system has something to do with doctors and hospitals. And if that isn't true, then it doesn't follow. Then you've got to be extremely careful saying, well, we're going to fix this problem with report cards. If the major problem is not, and I'm not saying it is, we just don't know. If the major problem is not what physicians are doing and what hospitals are doing, but it is rather lack of insurance and these other factors I named, illiteracy, patient dislike of doctors, then spending all this time and money on report cards is not going to be an effective response to the problem. And moreover, as I'll show in a minute, report cards could actually make the situation worse. So essentially we're calling for two things. More study on exactly why 65% of Minnesota diabetics do not have their cholesterol under control. We don't know why they don't. I suspect a huge reason is they don't have drug coverage. The medical director of Health Partners, in response to your question on the 8th, when you said to her, why didn't you risk adjust the scores to reflect these factors that are outside of physician control, her answer was, well, we knew that the better clinics were the better performers. I was begging you to say, how can you possibly know that if you haven't adjusted for the factors that were outside of physician control? If you're not collecting data on patient age, patient health insurance status, income, education, comorbidities, you haven't got a clue whether a given clinic or medical group is actually performing better than another group simply because 70% of their diabetics have their cholesterol under control compared to another clinic with 60%. Well, let me get to these slides. I think I've made the first point, which is we cannot conclude from existing data that simply says 65% of diabetics don't have their cholesterol under control that the solution is to do report cards. And we need more research on those causes. Now, let me turn to the argument I made briefly the last time I was here, which is report cards can damage quality of care. They can damage quality three ways. First, by being inaccurate. And if you don't adjust for risk, that's bound to happen. Secondly, even if the report cards are accurate, they can induce doctors to reject sicker patients. And we have data now from New York and Pennsylvania with rigorously adjusted report cards on heart surgery that that is in fact happening. And thirdly, by inducing doctors to shift resources from unmeasured to measured patients, you can possibly do damage to the unmeasured patients. And that seems not to be an issue that's on the radar screen for people who are promoting report cards. Here are a couple of quotes that I think just state the obvious. If you don't do risk adjustment, let me give you an example of risk adjustment. If the issue is quality of heart surgery and your quality measure is mortality rate within 30 days of surgery, if that's your quality measure, then you have to adjust those mortality rates to reflect differences in patient health. If I'm a surgeon treating all 50-year-olds with no other comorbidities other than maybe occluded coronary arteries, and you, Chairman Eber, are treating all 80-year-olds with diabetes and cancer and a whole lot of other things, I'm bound to beat you. I'm bound to make you look bad. And it would be an awful miscarriage of justice if you were punished for taking on those sick patients and I was rewarded with good publicity and prizes because I look better than you. The way you risk adjust is, and the way we keep you from rejecting sicker patients, is to say, all right, Chairman Eber, if you take this 80-year-old on, let's say we know that if you're 80, you have twice the risk of dying from heart surgery than if you're 50. We'll just take those simple age factor. What that means is that when you lose an 80-year-old patient, he dies on you within 30 days. His mortality counts as half a death. Meanwhile, my 50-year-old counts as 1.5. That's an example of risk adjustment. And so you're under that system, under no pressure to start getting rid of the 80-year-olds, because you know that if they die on you, it's not going to be as big a blemish on your record. It's a simple example, but I hope it illustrates what risk adjustment is. Now, everybody who writes on this subject, as opposed to people who come before you, and they're not PhDs and are not publishing in peer-reviewed journals, but virtually every expert who publishes in peer-reviewed journals says you have to risk adjust. And I could take up a lot of time quoting numerous experts who say that. I didn't think we needed to say that until the HMOs came out last year with their community measurement project and didn't even so much as adjust for age and sex. I was amazed. Here is an example of a study that found even your income can influence how often you get relatively inexpensive medical services, such as pap smears, mammograms, and diabetic eye exams. Now, these are differences in income amongst insured patients. We're not even talking about the uninsured. Just differences in income can influence the take-up rate for these services. Can a doctor dictate the income of his patients? Obviously not. Let's come back to this one. We went through this in some detail. It's an example of how your measure of quality rises depending upon how many factors you take into account. The Community Measurement Project, which is the name of the health the report card that the Council of Health Plans testified to you last week, here's one of their measures. Percent of patients with cholesterol LDL under 130. And in this case, it was a VA study, they found 73%. I think in Minnesota, the HMOs are saying it's 65%. Now, in this study, they said, well, let's ask what the doctor did after the high cholesterol reading came in. Good thing to do. And if the doctor changed, put the patient on a statin, which is the name of a cholesterol-lowering drug, or changed the type of statin, or the strength of the statin, lo and behold, or you take into account that the patient has contraindications, lo and behold, now 87% of the diabetics receive good quality care. And if you take in other factors outside of physician control, such as the patient is on a diet regimen, exercise, has sought active care elsewhere, refuses to take drugs, it rises to 90%. We don't know what causes the other 10%. I suspect there are also factors outside of physician control. Now, let me come to the New York report card, because it is considered the gold standard for report cards in the country. It was the first to be done on physicians as opposed to hospitals. It is considered the most accurate report card in America, and it has been more carefully scrutinized in the literature than any other report card. Here's a statement confirming what I'm saying. It is seen as the gold standard across the country. The reality is that these measures are the best available, and substantial improvements are not likely for some years. It is considered to be so good because they risk adjust 72 different factors. Here we have the HMOs in Minnesota can't even be bothered to adjust for age and sex. 72 factors by this report card published by the New York Department of Health. As you might imagine, it's expensive. The New York Department of Health itself has 5 full-time staff maintaining the database. They got a utilization review agent who audits the hospitals. And each of the 36 hospitals in New York has their own data collector. So you're looking at probably 40 full-time staff to produce this thing. We'll skip over its results, and we're going to get to the evidence that as rigorously done as this report card is, it is damaging quality of care. Here is a report done by David Dranov at Northwestern and another colleague, Mark McClellan, who is now Bush's director of Medicare when he was at Stanford, and another physician researcher at Stanford. What they found, looking at the New York report card, was our results show that report cards led to increased expenditures for both healthy and sick patients, marginal health benefits for healthy patients, and major adverse health consequences for sicker patients. More severely ill patients experienced dramatically worsened health outcomes. And the reason was the surgeons were starting to reject the sicker patients because they feared that the risk adjustment wouldn't get that mortality rate down to 50% or whatever it was in the example I was just giving. They concluded, mandatory reporting mechanisms inevitably give providers the incentive to decline to treat more difficult and complicated patients. Report cards led to a decline in the illness severity of patients receiving coronary artery bypass grafts in New York relative to patients to states without report cards. This is an interesting statement in New York Times Magazine about doctors in New York. The incentive to refuse treatment for high-risk patients has created a kind of spiritual crisis in the field of cardiac surgery. Heart surgeons are shrinking from taking on the toughest cases because of statistics. This is a quote from the number one ranked surgeon in New York in 1994 saying, I don't believe the report card is accurate and I would not make a decision based upon it. Interestingly enough, we are now seeing evidence that, is this a coronary artery? Yes, this is about angioplasty. The report cards I've been talking about to now have been bypass surgery. This is a study that just came out last January saying that cardiologists are now refusing to operate on sicker patients who might benefit from angioplasty, which is the balloon into the coronary artery, because they're worried about hurting their rankings on physician scorecards. 79% said they are now starting to refuse sicker patients.
This is productive, but you have to, we're just about out of time, so if you're going to take 1 minute to summarize, your point's so well made, I think.
It would be, I use the metaphor of a new drug. This legislature, the governor, should treat report cards like a new drug. It should not be released on the population until you've experimented with it on a pilot basis, and we know it's safe and effective. And moreover, you should treat it as a me-too drug, like, you know, the 25th painkiller. There are a lot of other ways to improve quality other than report cards. We don't have time to go into them. I'd love to come back and give you my sermon about that. To hear people report, who promote report cards, you'd think that the only way to improve quality is these report cards. There are at least a half a dozen rather obvious traditional methods of improving quality that we could talk about that we should be doing rather than report cards. Thank you very much.
If you want to write a memo to us, I will put it out to the members about the other ideas you have. And members, just to, thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan. Just to give you all a heads up, on March 2nd, I think the discussion group for mental health is going to sit down and do some work, and I'm glad to hear about that. We'll hear from them after that. My plan is 2 more weeks of testimony on the order of these kinds of topics. The pharmacists and the PBM people missed today for personal reasons. And we'll hear from them coming up. I think in 2 weeks we'll talk about best practices some more. And after that we'll start doing some, looking at some actual language you'll recognize as legislation that people will be bringing forward and that's been brought forward. So our last word for anybody? Thank you very much. Thanks for staying late, everybody. We're adjourned.